the application failed to state a legally sufficient ground for recall on the basis of incompetence or neglect of duties.
The Division of Elections rejects the Kyle Johansson recall petition. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, October 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, musk oxen deaths force changes at a UAF animal research facility.
It was a terrible thing that happened. We've made a lot of changes to try and hopefully make sure nothing like that happens again.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
The Alaska Division of Elections has rejected a recall application for Ketchikan Representative Kyle Johansson. District 1 Republicans who launched the recall effort in May plan to meet to decide whether to appeal. KRBD's Deanna Garrison has the story.
In a decision handed down on Monday, Division of Elections Director Gail Finumiai said the recall application was denied.
We reviewed the application thoroughly in consultation with the Department of Law and concluded that the application failed to state a legally sufficient ground for recall on the basis of incompetence or neglect of duties. The recall application centered around Representative Johansson's alleged forfeiture of his leadership position in the House during a caucus meeting and his failure to meet with and be available to his constituents. The summary contained no information or allegation that Representative Johansson engaged in any unlawful conduct, which is a legal standard for certifying a recall application.
According to state statute, an elected official may be recalled for one of four grounds: lack of fitness, incompetence, neglect of duties, and/or corruption. The recall application filed in August cited incompetence and neglect of duties as the two primary reasons for the recall. District 1 Republican Chair Dick Coos was one of the recall application sponsors.
Naturally, we're not happy with what the law department did, and quite frankly, I read the 21 pages, and I can't believe all the gobbledygook in there, but that's lawyers for you.
Application sponsors had collected 594 signatures, 63 more than required to file the recall application with the state. Finumiai says recall sponsors can appeal the Division of Elections decision.
They can file an action in Superior Court within 30 days of the date on which I gave them notice of my determination. And if they did file something in court and the court said the state was correct, then Representative Johansson could not be recalled from office based on this current application. But if the court reversed the division's action, then such a decision would allow the recall committee to do the next step of the recall process, which would be actually going out and gathering more signatures.
Petition sponsors have until November 9th to file the legal appeal. Coos says he plans to call a meeting of District 1 Republicans to discuss whether to proceed with an appeal.
We'll be getting together within the next week and deciding just what we're going to do, and I don't know what that'll be yet.
Coos says the meeting will be open to the general public. Representative Johansson declined to be interviewed for this story. However, in a written statement, Johansson says he was thankful the state found the recall application lacked, quote, any grounds for removal. He says he realizes he has work to do with a number of District 1 constituents who supported the recall. Johansson says he will continue to communicate, work hard for his district, and move ahead on issues. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
A U.S. Department of Agriculture report blames the University of Alaska Fairbanks for the death of a dozen musk oxen at the university's large animal research station last fall. The recently issued USDA report follows a routine inspection, but cites several issues specifically related to the musk oxen die-off, including an insufficient number of adequately trained large staff. Also noted is the facility veterinarian's additional role as head of research, a situation, it says, resulted in perceived fear of reprisal by staff if they contacted him about animal welfare. welfare. UAF spokeswoman Miriam Grimes says there's nothing new in the report. She says Lars has been in consultation with the USDA since the musk oxen die-off to address the problems.
All of the items listed in the USDA report have already been corrected. We brought in two different consultants, one to kind of handle the medical veterinary side of things, and then another one to evaluate our animal care system campus-wide.
Grimes says that's resulted in a number of changes in animal care, including separate people to handle veterinary care and research aspects of the program. The musk oxen die-off was traced to a mineral deficiency caused by a new dietary supplement. Grimes says the musk oxen herd has recovered since the trace mineral problem was addressed, but UAF takes full responsibility for what happened.
We did make mistakes, absolutely. And that was a terrible thing that happened. We've made a lot of changes to try and hopefully make sure nothing like that happens again.
A lower 48 animal welfare group is pressing the USDA to more fully investigate animal care at UAF in light of what happened. Ohio-based Stop Animal Exploitation Now co-founder Michael Budke says there's something seriously wrong at the Lars facility if so many large animals could be allowed to die.
This isn't something that happens overnight. And one of the most disturbing parts of this is that it's clear from the federal report that the animal caretakers were actually told not to communicate with the facility's own veterinarian about what was happening to these animals. So it appears that there was some kind of an internal cover-up underway at the University of Alaska. And that makes us concerned not only for these animals, but for every animal within these facilities.
Budke has written to the USDA seeking an in-depth inquiry and proceedings to levy the university with a major fine. The former EAC Tech employee accused of bribery and money laundering appeared in federal court today in Washington. Harold Babb's attorney is trying to get him released on bond before he goes to trial, but Judge Magistrate Deborah Robinson says she'll decide that next week. First, Babb's lawyer will get to review tapes the government has, which prosecutors say show Babb engaging in illegal activities. Babb was arrested last week and accused of scheming with Army Corps of Engineers employees to steal $20 million from government contracts by padding invoices. The government wants to detain Babb. Prosecutors argued he's a flight risk because he's traveled internationally recently and might have money stashed in hiding. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, sled dogs are essential in Denali National Park, and being a ranger there used to require this mushing test.
Go ahead and hook up a dog team there. Go out and travel the park for 2 weeks. If you come back, you've got a job.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at AlaskaPublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. AlaskaPublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
The North Slope Borough Mayor's race is heading for a runoff election. Three candidates were vying for the position: Charlotte Brower, former Borough Mayor George Amawak Sr., and Fenton Rexford. Brower received 639 votes, Amawak 601, and Rexford 583. The race is now between Brower and Amawak. The runoff election will take place on November 8th. A Wales man was sentenced last week to 15 days in jail for failing to ensure his child attended school. KNOM's Ben Matheson has the story.
Michael Akinga Sr. was charged with five misdemeanor counts of contributing to the delinquency of minors under 16 through truancy. He pleaded guilty and was convicted on one charge, with the remaining four being dropped. District Attorney John Earthman says jail time is quite rare in truancy cases.
Well, this is the first time that I'm aware of, certainly the first time in this region. I've been here 12 years, and this is the first one of these to get this far, and you really have to basically work at it to get yourself in this position.
Court documents show that Akinga was instructed to escort his 11-year-old son to school according to an agreement with the Wales school, but he had failed to do so. A trooper affidavit says Akinga's son missed 27 days in the 2008-2009 year, 13 days the following year, and was absent 54 days in the first half of the 2010-2011 year. The DA filed charges this June against four parents in Wales and Shishmaref for truancy problems. Rob Piku, the superintendent of the Bering Strait School District, says he's saddened that parents are facing jail time for contributing to truancy.
But that number is low compared to the great many of parents that do get their kids to school well-rested and ready to learn every day. So I wouldn't say that it's an overwhelming problem of truancy, but there are isolated incidences where there are parents who are not able to get their kids to school every day well-rested.
Alaska law requires students between the ages of 7 and 16 to attend school, but the path to criminal cases takes a few years. The Bering Strait School District's attendance policies introduce greater levels of involvement as absences accrue. After three unexcused absences, the school calls parents or makes a home visit. At 5, a letter is sent to inform parents of legal consequences. The school arranges a meeting between parents and school leaders to come up with solutions. After 10 absences, a letter is sent to the district attorney. The DA begins with non-criminal actions, issuing violations for each 5 days a student is absent from school. Earthman says parents can be charged up to $500 for each violation.
That's the way we start with these, because we always give the parents a chance to fix the problem and also to identify if there's another problem, because sometimes kids have, you know, it may be them just refusing to go. I mean, sometimes the parents are trying, but we don't just go right to a criminal charge, let's put it that way.
Alaska law is not very explicit in defining the requirements to make the jump to a criminal case. Earthman says each situation is different, but criminal charges require some action by parents that contributes to their child's attendance problem.
You know, if they're providing a place for the kids to stay when they're not, when they're supposed to be in school, if they're, you know, basically covering, you know, if they're just going through the motions in the course of violation proceedings or just with the school, to me, that's just they've made an affirmative choice and they've provided a circumstance where the kids can not have to go to school.
As for measures to prevent truancy, BSSD Superintendent Piku says the district is working towards increasing student engagement. He cites plans for a more flexible high school program called 10 plus 2. This would allow students to create individualized studies and choose their own path. He says making school an enriching place can help combat truancy.
The issue of relevancy is something we talk about on a daily basis, how to make education more relevant for children, how to give children a vision of themselves in the future so that they can work toward an end goal, which would be to be a productive, contributing member of society.
DA Earthman says the criminal cases are unfortunate, but ultimately it is the students that suffer.
My bottom line is parents need to get those kids to school, and the more of that happens, the less involvement from the state, for sure. And that's the way it should be. You know, life's pretty tough out there and here, and these kids just can't afford to be undereducated. They just can't.
Earthman says the Kotzebue region now has two attorneys on staff and is organizing to be able to take on truancy cases. Reporting in Nome, I'm Ben Matheson.
The Regulatory Commission of Alaska has approved a power purchase agreement between Anchorage-based Chugach Electric and Fire Island Wind LLC, a wind power farm owned by Cook Inlet Region Incorporated. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Alternative energy advocates are hailing a decision by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska that will enable a wind power project to go forward. After several days of deliberation, the RCA closed the docket on a bid by Chugach Electric to buy power from the Fire Island Wind Farm. The decision, made late Monday night, allows the project to proceed with financing and construction this year. Steve Cleary is with the Alaska Public Interest Research Group, or ACPIRG.
You know, there's been some other great successes around the state, Kodiak, Kotzebue, on a smaller scale, but this will be a big signature project. And again, we think it's a great investment in the future. We think it's going to be a really good resource for Alaska to tap into, and a great way to take a step towards the 50% renewable energy goal that by 2025 that the legislature and the governor enacted.
The sticking point during RCA deliberations was the amount of the purchase price that Chugach could pass on to its customers through cost adjustments. The RCA order allows Chugach to make payments to Fire Island through cost adjustments to its fuel and power purchases that are passed on to Chugach power consumers, according to RCA spokesperson Ann Wild. The RCA order also requires Chugach to release other utilities that are connected to the Rail Belt energy grid from responsibility for any extra costs that may be incurred from lapses in wind power. And Chugach must disclose to its members the cost of the wind power and must file status reports. Chugach Electric is a member-owned utility with 80,000 metered customers. Chugach spokesman Phil Steyer says it's premature to comment on the decision pending a meeting of Chugach's board of directors set for Wednesday. The City of Anchorage's Municipal Light and Power was an intervener in the RCA discussion because the utility operators were concerned that if something went wrong with the wind power supply, that Rail Belt utilities would be saddled with extra costs. ML&P General Manager Jim Posey could not be reached for comment. The RCA made an expedited decision in the case, citing as its reason the fact that the Fire Island Wind Project would be abandoned unless the matter of cost recovery was resolved. The RCA's approval allows for nearly 4% of Chugach's energy needs to be powered by wind energy. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Several Alaska communities are making plans for geothermal generation of electricity. They're also learning from existing projects and mistakes. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has this report.
When you're trying to tap geothermal energy for heating or electrical generation, you've got to consider a number of factors.
The temperature is the obvious one, so hotter is better. That's pretty intuitive. Flow rate is really important, though, too.
Gwen Holdman is director of the University of Alaska's Center for Power and Energy. She spoke at the recent Rural Alaska Energy Conference in Juneau.
You might have a really high temperature resource, and one good example that's pretty close by here is Tenakee Springs. They have a fairly high temperature, but they have an extremely low flow rate.
You also need to know the dimensions of the hot water reservoir, its depth, and the rate it recharges itself. Another important factor is location. Being close to a city or transmission line makes tapping power more affordable. That's why the Aleutian Islands City of Accutan and the local Trident Seafoods plant are looking at nearby Hot Springs Valley.
We hit water as hot as 350 plus at 500 feet.
Ray Mann is a consultant for the city of Accutan, northeast of Unalaska.
But according to the studies that have been done, that's the outflow resource, and we probably will not get the flow that we need and the capacity we need, so we have to go further back up valley to reach the upflow zone. And the estimate is that we could achieve anywhere between 15 and 100 megawatts, minimum of 8 megawatts, to provide power.
Outflow is where water comes from the ground. Inflow is the subterranean area where it travels to near the surface. There's been interest in the Accutan site for at least 30 years. New wells were drilled this and last year, one finding water up to 500 degrees. Deep water is under enough pressure that it does not boil off at those temperatures, and other studies further define the resource. Mann says the city is committed to building an approximately $60 million plant, including about 5 miles of road and transmission lines. He says it could bring down power costs from 66 cents a kilowatt hour without power cost equalization to around 13 cents. Studies have shown it's a better option than wind or hydropower.
This has been the option, number one, because of the proximity of this resource, the size of the resource. There really aren't that many other applications that are going to generate 7 to 8 megawatts for you the way that this will do. And again, because it's right there and accessible.
7 or 8 megawatts is what Accutan needs, including the seafood plant. Trident is conducting its own study, and Mann says they're working together. He says the town already has about $10 million toward the project. It's seeking another $15 million from government sources and $45 million in private sector investments. That could include Trident. Energy conference speakers say another area with a significant geothermal resource is Pilgrim Hot Springs near Nome.
We selected this site because we thought it was one that had potential to be developed to benefit the region.
Gwen Holdman of the Center for Power and Energy says the former spa was first drilled in the late 1970s. She says the crew found two surprises.
They didn't hit bedrock, which was pretty interesting. They went down to 1,000 feet. And then the second thing that happened is that they drilled through a really shallow layer of super hot water, like up to 200 degrees Fahrenheit. That's really hot. That's barely below boiling temperature.
More drilling took place in the past 2 years. The work is not finished, but agencies think it's worth developing. Holdman says studies show the resource could produce more than enough electricity to power Nome.
Right now, the estimated potential for power generation is approximately 5 megawatts. We haven't found anything to change that number at this point in time. That's still a viable number.
A preliminary report released about 4 years ago estimated total cost at $50 to $115 million, depending on the depth and generation system. A final report is due in about a year and a half. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Solstice Advertising, bringing creativity to Alaska businesses and nonprofits. From research and strategy to print, web, and broadcast production, Solstice Advertising, an agency for brands that want to shine.
The 8th Annual Bioneers in Alaska Conference, Adapting to a Changing Planet, is October 14th through the 16th at UAA. Presentations include renewable energy, urban homesteading, sustainability workshops, and keynote speaker Thomas Elpel. Storyteller Tamarack Song will speak at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium on October 15th as part of the conference, but tickets are available to the public at the door. Details at bioneersinak.org. This message sponsored by GreenStar.
The state's new sport fish hatchery in Fairbanks could go into operation by December. The behind schedule and over budget facility has been plagued by problems with a water treatment system that has failed to work at high water flows. Contractor CH2M Hill has been working to rectify the problem at the Ruth Burnett Sport Fish Hatchery, which was originally scheduled to come online more than a year ago. Hatchery manager Gary George says things finally look promising.
This is closer than we've ever gone, ever been. The water has performed as well as it ever has. At these flows, we've never come close to meeting targets as consistently as we have. And I think we're all very encouraged at this point.
Fairbanks groundwater needs to be treated to rear fish. The hatchery is in the midst of a 30-day performance test to make sure the system can handle power outages and other upsets. George says if it passes, the hatchery could start operating before the new year, starting with fingerling trout.
December 1st, I would hope we would have fish in here, and then we'll also be able to take Arctic char eggs this spring as well.
George says other species will follow. The hatchery is designed to rear rainbow trout, king and silver salmon, Arctic char, and Arctic grayling to stock interior waters. It's unclear how much the water system fix will add to the hatchery's $46 million price tag. That figure is already twice what the state originally estimated. An Alaska woman escaped serious injury by mere inches in an auto accident while sitting in her living room today. Nadine Lefevre of Anchorage was still in her bathrobe sitting in an easy chair this morning when an SUV crashed through the front wall of her house. By the time it stopped, the vehicle was entirely inside her living room and barely missed her purple chair. Police spokesman Lieutenant Dave Parker says someone was looking out for her. Authorities say the driver of the vehicle was southbound on a major thoroughfare, lost control of the SUV, and went east straight into Lefevre's home. The driver had minor injuries and was transported to a local hospital. The cause of the crash is under investigation. With the approach of winter, Alaska's sled dogs prepare for a new season. Some teams train for races, others mush with tourists, and many run for recreation. For Denali National Park's 34 sled dogs, though, winter means work. Diana Saverin has the story.
Denali's Alaskan Huskies play a vital role in the park, even if they don't wear Park Service gray and greens. They are the U.S. government's only official sled dogs, and they represent a piece of park history. Mushing played a significant role in the park's founding and development. Jennifer Raffaelli is kennel manager for Denali National Park.
The old story goes that the way Harry Carstens hired the first few rangers was to point out the dogs, point out a sled, and say, go ahead and hook up a dog team there. Go out and travel the park for 2 weeks. If you come back, you've got a job. If you don't come back, I'll come look for you, but you better have another job in mind. So Harry expected those early rangers to be competent dog mushers as well.
Today, not all of the work is so grueling. The dogs get quite a bit of attention in the summer from adoring tourists. Jennifer says some have never heard of mushing before.
But most of them have pets and a lot of them have dogs at home. So when they see our dogs and they can physically pet them and tangibly connect with these dogs and then start to think about where these dogs go and what they see, you know, after summertime ends, is really inspiring to park visitors and helps us share our stories in a way that I think is hard for just human beings to do.
Unlike most park staff, who must find other employment in the winter, the park's 34 dogs stick around as true year-round employees. The Denali Wilderness transitions into a frozen landscape. It is during these months, the park's off-season, that the dogs enjoy their on-season. Because much of the park is a wilderness area, no snow machines are allowed. But Jennifer says in many ways the dogs offer better transportation. Like last winter, when she was trying to find a backcountry cabin with her dog team.
And we were traveling down the river and it was starting to get dark and I'm reading the GPS and looking at the maps and I know that the cabin is nearby, but I don't know exactly where it is. And all of a sudden our lead dogs, Gator and Yakone, just took a 90-degree left-hand turn off the trail, off the river, into the woods. And I was like, huh. So I stopped the team, hopped off the sled, and sure enough, we were on a tiny little trail through the woods to this cabin that we would not have seen from the river. And our law enforcement rangers had a hard time. They pulled up and stopped their snow machines at the wilderness boundary and continued on trying to find the cabin, but they couldn't find it nearly as easily as we could.
Jennifer isn't the only park employee to notice sled dogs' unique advantages. In 1946, the internal combustion engine was first presenting itself as a rival to the dog team. The park superintendent's report from that year read, "All patrols were made in the M7 snow jeep, which worked unsatisfactorily." But park ranger Rumor wrote, "The distance traveled in a day exceeds the best a dog could perform, but the dogs have less trouble with carburetors." And today, Denali National Park's dog teams log 3,000 miles a season, taking park rangers on patrol and hauling freight, all without carburetor trouble. For APRN, and with help from Jonathan Christ-Tompkins, I'm Diana Savrin.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ben Matheson in Nome, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Diana Savrin in Denali National Park. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Condor Airlines, with connecting flights from Barrow, Bethel, Juneau, Kodiak, Nome, and Prudhoe Bay to Anchorage on Alaska Airlines, and continuing nonstop service to Frankfurt. Details at condor.com. October is Alaska Energy Awareness Month, a time to focus on what we're doing to meet Alaska's energy needs and reduce consumption in our everyday lives. For more information, go to akenergyefficiency.org. Energy efficiency in Alaska, it's common sense. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.